no further dreams come. When the morning bell rings, I raise my head off the pillow, my body stiff and sore. A cold rain beats against the window. I glance across the room and see Ella sitting up, lifting her arms towards the ceiling, yawning deeply. We shuffle from the room together, saying nothing. We coast about our Sunday routines and sit through Mass with our heads hung. At one point, I nudge Ella awake, and 20 minutes later, she returns the favor. I survive El Festín lunchline, doling out food while looking for anyone suspicious. When everything appears normal, I can't decide if I'm relieved or disappointed. What saddens me most is that I don't see Hector. Towards the end of cleanup, LaGuardia and Gabby begin horsing around, spraying each other with a hose attached to the kitchen sink as I dry dishes. I ignore them, even when I get splashed in the face. 20 minutes later, when I've just finished drying the last dish, carefully placing it atop the tall stack, a girl named Delfina slips on the wet floor and bumps into me, causing me to fall into the stack and send all 30 plates back into the dirty water, where some of them break. "Why don't you watch what you're doing?" I say, and I push her with one arm. Delfina spins around and shoves me right back.
"Hey!"
Sister Dora barks from across the kitchen.
"You too! Knock it off! Right now!"
"You're going to pay for that," Delfina says. I can't wait to be officially done with Santa Teresa. "Whatever," I say, still scowling. She nods at me, a malicious look upon her face. "Watch your back."
"If I have to come over there, Lord help me, you are going to regret it," Sister Dora says.
Instead of using telekinesis to toss Delfina through the roof, or Sister Dora, or Gabby, or LaGuardia for that matter, I turn back to the dishes. When I'm finally free, I walk outside. It's still raining, and I stand under the eaves and look towards the cave. The mud will be thick on the mountainside, which means I'd get filthy. I use that as an excuse for why I won't go. Though I know that even if it weren't raining, I wouldn't have the courage, despite my curiosity of whether or not new boot prints have been made in the mud. I walk back inside. Ella's Sunday duties require her to clean the nave after everyone leaves, wiping down pews. But when I go there, everything has already been cleaned. "Have you seen Ella?" I ask a 10-year-old girl named Valentina. She shakes her head. I walk back to our bedroom, but there's no sign of Ella there. I sit on her bed. The bounce of the mattress causes a silver object to peek from beneath Ella's pillow. It's a tiny flashlight. I flip it on. The light shines brightly. I turn it off and put it back where I found it, so that the sisters won't see it. I walk the halls, peeking in rooms as I go along. Because of the rain, most of the girls have stayed in, milling about in their small groups, laughing and talking and playing games. On the second floor, where the hallway splits and leads to the church's two separate wings, I go left, down a dark, dusty corridor. Empty rooms and ancient statues cut into the rock wall and arched ceiling, and I stick my head in the doorways, looking for Ella. No sign of her. The hallway narrows, and the dusty odor segues to a damp, earthy smell. At the corridor's end stands a padlocked oak door I jimmied open a week and a half ago, looking for the chest. Beyond the door, it's a stone stairway that circles around the narrow tower leading up to the north belfry, which holds one of Santa Teresa's two bells. The chest wasn't there either. I surf the internet for a while, but find nothing new about John Smith. Then I go to the sleeping quarters, lie in bed, and feign sleep. Thankfully, LaGuardia, Gabby, and Delfina don't come into the room. And I don't see Ella either. I crawl from bed and walk down the hall. I enter the nave, and find Ella in the back pew. I sit beside her. She smiles up at me, looking tired. This morning, I had put her hair into a ponytail, but now it's come loose. I pull the band free, and Ella turns her head so I can redo it. "Where have you been all day?" I ask. "I was looking for you."
"I was exploring," she says proudly.
I instantly feel terrible all over again for ignoring her on our walks to school. We leave and go to our room, say goodnight to one another. Slipping beneath the covers, waiting for the lights to be shut off, I feel hopeless and sad, wanting to simply crawl into a ball and cry. So that's what I do. I wake in the middle of the night, and I can't tell what time it is, though I assume I've slept at least a few hours. I roll over and close my eyes again, but something feels off. There's some change in the room I can't quite explain, and it amplifies the same anxiety I've felt all week. I open my eyes again, and the second they adjust to the dark, I realize a face is staring at me. I gasp and bolt straight backwards, crashing into the wall behind me. I'm trapped, I think. Trapped in the far back corner. How stupid of me to have wanted this bed. My hands tighten, and just as I'm about to scream and kick at the face, I recognize the brown eyes.
Ella.
I instantly relax. I wonder how long she's been standing there. Very slowly, she brings her tiny index finger to her lips. Then her eyes widen, and she smiles as she leans forward. She cups her hand around my ear.
"I found the chest,"
she whispers. I pull away, look earnestly into her radiant, upturned face, and know immediately she's telling the truth. My own eyes widen. I can't contain my excitement. I pull her to me and give her the tightest hug her small body can endure.
"Oh, Ella, you have no idea how proud I am of you." "I told you I'd find it. I told you, because we're a team and we help each other."
"We do," I whisper. I let go of her. Her face brims with pride.
"Come on, I'll show you where it is."
She takes me by the hand, and I follow her around the bed, tiptoeing quietly. The chest! A bright ray of hope when I'd least expected it, when I'd needed it most. Chapter 16. We flee the room, and I have the urge to sprint to wherever Ella's leading me. She glides swiftly and soundlessly across the cold floor. The corridor is dark, and while I see everything clearly, every so often Ella flicks on the flashlight to orient herself, then quickly turns it off. When we reach the nave, I think she's going to head towards the North Tower, but she doesn't, and instead guides me up the center aisle. We skitter past the rows of pews. At the nave's front, stained glass saints line the curved wall, and the moonlight behind them brings a celestial radiance that gives each a more biblical appearance than they've ever had before. Water drips in a constant patter somewhere. Ella cuts a right turn at the front pew and sweeps towards one of the many open recesses that run the length of both walls. I follow. The air is cooler here than in the nave, and a tall statue of the Virgin Mary looms over us with arms lifted from her sides. Ella goes around her, and when she reaches the back left corner, she turns to me.
"I'll have to bring it down to you," she says, putting the flashlight in her mouth.
She takes hold of the stone pillar and scoots up it like a squirrel clawing up a tree. All I can do is watch in amazement, so impressed by her mobility. When she's almost at the ceiling, she pauses and then swings around the column, disappearing into a tight little nook that's almost invisible from where I stand. I never noticed the nook before. Lord knows how Ella did. I crane my head to listen, hearing the rough friction of her shoes scrape along the rock, which means there's just enough room for her to crawl. Some kind of tunnel. I can't help but smile. I knew the chest was here, somewhere, but I would have never found it in a million years if it weren't for Ella. I laugh at the thought of Adelina scaling the same column with the chest so many years ago. Ella has stopped. I hear nothing. 20 seconds pass.
Ella!
I whisper. She sticks her head out and looks down.
Should I come up?
She shakes her head.
It's stuck, but I almost have it. I'll bring it down to you in a minute,
she whispers back, and then yanks her head back in and disappears. I can't take the suspense of not knowing what's going on up there. I look at the base of the column and take hold of it, and just before I'm about to try climbing it, I hear a noise behind me that sounds like somebody's kicking a pew. I spin around. The Virgin Mary blocks my view. I walk around her and scan the nave, but I don't see anything.
I got it,
I hear Ella exclaim. I rush back around the statue and look up, waiting for her to appear. I can hear her grunt and struggle to drag the chest to the nook's opening, and I have no idea if it's because the chest is heavy or because the tunnel is so narrow. Little by little, the dragging continues. I feel nothing short of ecstasy at finally having the chest in my possession, and I don't even consider the problem of getting it open. I'll cross that bridge when I come to it. Just as Ella is almost to the opening, I hear something else behind me.
What are you doing up?
I whip around. Divided equally on each side of the Virgin Mary, Gabby and Delfina stand under the statue's left arm, while LaGorda and a wiry Bonita, the champion of the dock game that almost got me killed at the lake, position themselves beneath the right arm. I glance over my shoulder and see two small eyes peering down at us from the nook's opening.
What do you want?
I ask.
I wanted to see what the little tattletale was up to, that's all.
You know, it's funny, because I saw you sneak out of the room, and I thought that I would get up and finally see what it was you're always looking at on the computer. But you weren't there.
Gabby paints a sarcastic, confused look on her face.
You were in here, which is really weird.
Really weird. It's really weird,
LaGorda says. To my relief, I don't hear Ella dragging the chest anymore.
Why do you even care? I say. Seriously, all I ever do is keep to myself and keep my mouth shut.
I care a lot about you, Marina, Gabby says, stepping forward.
She flips her long dark hair.
In fact, I care so much that I worry about you hanging out with that loser drunk, Hector, all the time.
Do you get drunk with him?
She pauses.
Do you drink from his bottle?
I don't know if it was because she called Hector a loser, or because she thought our friendship was anything more than just that, or because she's snooping on what I'm doing at the computer, but it just happens. I close my eyes and reach out with my mind, grabbing all four of them at once. LaGorda screams, while the other three whimper in shock. I pick them up off the ground, their bare feet kicking at the air, their shoulders smashed against each other's, and thrust them all across the smooth floor until they bounce off the steps leading to the raised dais at the back of the nave. LaGorda slaps the floor with her open palms and gets to her feet like an angry bull ready to charge the conquistador. I run to her instead, making up the ground in a matter of seconds. LaGorda swings a wild punch, and I duck, only to spring up and jam my right fist into her chin. She falls backwards with a gasp, and her head thuds against the floor. She's out cold. Bonita jumps on my back and pulls at my hair. Someone punches me in the left cheek, and the other kicks me in the shin. Bonita slides down my back and hugs my upper arm so I can't move. Delphina swings, and I duck. The punch glances off Bonita's mouth, and she loosens her grip enough for me to twist away. I grab Bonita's right arm in my hands, and I drive her towards Gabby.
You're dead, Marina! You are so dead!
Bonita shrieks, and I pull her sideways and knee her in the gut, knocking the wind out of her. I shove her to the ground next to La Gorda. Delphina's confidence is broken. She looks for the door.
You ready to leave me alone?
I ask her.
Doesn't matter. I'm going to get you tomorrow,
she says.
Right when you're not looking. You're going to wish you didn't say that.
I fake right and lunge left, tackling her around the waist. Gabby tries to grab my hair, but I whip Delphina around to block her. Then I pivot on my heels and release Delphina down the middle aisle of the nave. Her back hits the first step at the altar, and her groan echoes off the vaulted ceiling. Gabby circles me.
I'm telling Sister Dora. You're going to be in so much trouble.
I turn my body to keep my eyes on her. She stops right next to the column. I can tell she's about to charge, and I'm ready for it. Suddenly, I see a flash of white above Gabby's head. It takes me a second to recognize that it's Ella, and she's jumped from the nook all the way down onto Gabby's shoulders. Gabby flails around until she can get her hands on Ella, and when she does, she tosses her onto the floor with a horrible cracking sound.
No!
I yell, and then I punch Gabby in the sternum as hard as I can. Her feet leave the ground, and she hits the wall, knocking dust from the stone wall's mortar. Ella's on her back, wailing, writhing in pain, but I notice she keeps her right leg completely still. I kneel beside her and pull up the bottom of her nightgown to see a sharp white bone sticking out of her skin, just below the knee. I don't know what to do. I put my hand on her shoulders to try to console her, but she's in so much pain, she doesn't feel it. I'm right here, Ella, I say. I'm here right beside you, and everything's going to be okay. Her eyes open, and she gives me a pleading look. It's then that I see the damage done to her right hand. Her tiny fist is mangled, crooked. Blood seeps out between her index and middle fingers. Her talent.
Oh my God, Ella, I'm sorry,
I cry.
I'm so, so sorry.
She just cries. I feel myself begin to sweat. Never in my life have I felt so useless.
Try not to move, I say,
knowing it's a futile plea. The nearest hospital is a half-hour drive. She'll pass out from the pain by then. She starts to rock in a rhythm from side to side. I hover my shaking hands over the shard of bone sticking out of her leg, not knowing if I should apply pressure or try to push it back under the skin. I decide on applying pressure, and the second my fingers touch her skin, Ella stutters with a sharp intake of breath. An icy tingle inches up my spine, a feeling much like the times I've brought life back to the flower in the computer room, and the feeling spreads throughout the rest of me. Is it possible that my ability to heal plants applies to people as well? Ella stops crying and starts breathing rapidly, her tiny chest rising and falling, rising and falling. I can feel the iciness concentrate in my palms and circulate outwards from my fingertips.
I think I can fix you.
Her chest continues to rise and fall at an abnormal speed, but her face takes on a look of peacefulness, of detachment. I'm afraid to, but I place my hands over the piece of bone that sticks out from her leg. I feel its pebbly, broken end, and soon it begins to retreat back under the skin. The puncture wound turns from red and white back to the color of her skin, and I can see the jagged contours of her broken bone move and shift within her leg, setting itself back in place. I'm amazed at what I've just done. This could be my most important legacy yet. Keep still, I say. One more thing. I close my eyes and wrap my hands around her thin right wrist. The iciness flows again through my fingertips. I open my eyes to watch her palm rise and her fingers spread away from each other. The cut between her index and middle fingers closes, and I see two broken knuckles straighten and mend. Ella clenches her hand and relaxes it. I've done what Lorien has intended me to do, and that's to undo damage that's been inflicted on those who don't deserve it. Ella turns her head to the right to look at my hands wrapped around her wrist. You're fine, I say. You're better than fine. She raises her head off the ground and props herself up onto her elbows. I pull her into my arms. We're a team, I whisper into her ear. We take care of each other. Thanks for trying to help. She nods her head. I squeeze her and then pull away. I look around at the girls, all of them unconscious but breathing. Sticking out of the opening of the nave, I see the edge of the chest. I'm so proud of you for finding the chest. You have no idea, I say. Let's get it tomorrow morning, after we've had some rest.
Are you sure?
Ella asks.
I can climb back up and get it.
No, no. You go wash up in the bathroom, and I'll be right there. When she's finally out of my sight, I raise my eyes to the chest. Concentrating, I float it silently down to my feet. Now, I just need to get Adelina to open it with me.
Chapter 17. As I burst through the burning door and land on the melting brown carpet of the living room, several things race through my mind. Sam. Henri's letter, the chest, Henri's ashes. I engulf myself purposefully in flames in order to move easily from room to room. Sam! I yell. Where are you, Sam? Past the living room, I see that the entire back wall of the house is burning. The house could collapse in a matter of a minute. I dart into the bedrooms calling Sam's name. The bathroom door explodes with my kick. I check the kitchen, the dining room, and just when I'm about to try the living room again, I look out the window and see the chest and a pile of our belongings, including the laptop, the coffee can of Henri's ashes, and the unopened letter on the lip of the pool. Something small bobs in the middle of the water. It's Sam's head. He sees me and waves his arms. I crash through the window and knock over the grill. I dive into the pool, the flames surrounding me hissing into gray and black smoke. You okay?
I think so, he says.
We pull ourselves out of the water and stand over everything Sam was able to save. What happened?
Dude, they're here. They're totally here, the Mogadorians.
The moment he says these words, I feel sick to my stomach. My jaw quivers. Then Sam says,
I saw them in the front window, and then, boom, the house is on fire. I grabbed what I could.
There's movement on the roof. Between fissures of rising flames, I see a huge Mogadorian scout in a black trench coat, hat, and sunglasses marching down the decline, his feet sinking into the soft tiles with every step. He carries a long, gleaming sword. I kneel and grab a hold of the chest's lock, and it yields under my glowing grip. Brushing aside the crystals at the bottom of the chest, I pick up the dagger with the diamond blade. Flames dancing from the house reflect in its sharp edge. To my surprise, the handle extends and wraps itself around my entire right hand.
Get back, I say to Sam.
The scout reaches the metal eave of the collapsing roof, and he drops onto the patio below, his feet cracking the concrete when he lands. He slices the sword in the air in front of him, and it leaves a glowing trail. I control my breath and go over the last week of training in my mind. The moment my feet push me forward, the scout roars and rushes at me with his trench coat billowing behind him. I see myself in his sunglasses the second before his sword swings across my body. I lean back far enough for him to miss me, but when I right myself, I enter the glowing trail the sword left behind. Pain attaches itself to my neck and travels to my waist. I'm knocked backwards and into the pool. When my head surfaces, I see Sam squaring off with the scout. His bare hands are up and out. He bobs his shoulders left and right. The scout laughs and drops his sword to the concrete. And then he mimics Sam's fighting stance. Before I can heave myself out of the pool to help, Sam drops his weight onto his left foot and circles his right behind him. His sopping right shoe comes back around and connects with the scout's face with a force that staggers him back several feet. The dazed scout picks up his gleaming sword. I'm up out of the pool before he can reach Sam, and I lift my dagger to block the plummeting sword. The blades meet, and there is a ball of light so bright I can't see for an instant. When the light fades, the scout's sword breaks at the exact spot my dagger collided with it. Not wasting the moment of surprise, I plunge the blade of my dagger into his chest and rip it downward. He turns to ash and it covers my feet. The house finally collapses. Beams of wood crack in different directions. Windows pop and explode from the walls, the roof flattening over it all like a book with a broken spine. A storm cloud appears overhead, and a lightning bolt slices through the sky, landing just on the other side of the house. "We have to get to six," Sam shouts. He's right. The proximity of the lightning can only mean she's in the middle of a battle, or finishing one. With my one free hand, I heft the chest up and over the backyard's brick wall, after making sure the coast is clear. Sam tosses the rest up to me, and I then pull him to the wall cement top. We jump and roll on the moist grass beyond the wall. Securing everything behind a thick bush, we run around to the front yard. In the middle of the driveway, just feet from our SUV, Six has a scout and a headlock, the muscles in her arms pulsing in the squeeze. Two more scouts are approaching. One aims a long, cylindrical tube right at me, and a green light blasts me backwards. I can't breathe. I can't see. I roll into the high grass and feel the heat from the house. When I'm able to open my eyes, I see the scout with the tube standing above me. I slowly regain some feeling in my arms and legs. My breathing returns to normal. The handle of the dagger still encases my right hand. The scout adjusts a knob on the tube, perhaps going from stun to kill. And then he steps on my right wrist. I try swinging my legs up and over me, but they don't react the way I want them to. Still sluggish from the paralyzing blast I just endured. The barrel of the tube is set between my eyes, and I think about the gun Six turned on the drunk man just an hour ago. This is it, I think. The Mogadorian's mission is a success. Number four, check. On to number five. I watch hundreds of lights in the tube spark to life, swirling until they become one, just as he puts his finger on the trigger. Bernie Kosar clamps down on his thigh. The scout wobbles above me for a second before his head is separated from his body by a bolt of lightning. It rolls in the grass right next to mine. Our noses touch before the head crumbles into a pile of ash. And I do everything I can not to breathe it in. The body above me falls over and covers my jeans with ash. "Get up already!" Six yells, suddenly in the exact spot the scout had been. Sam appears above me, too, his face stern and dirty.
"We have to leave right now, John."
The sound of sirens pierces the night. A mile away, maybe less, Bernie Kosar licks my left temple and whimpers.
"What about the third one?" I whisper.
Six looks over at Sam and nods.
"I got a hold of his sword and used it against him. Best moment of my life," he says.
I'm draped over Six's shoulder, and she dumps me into the back seat of the SUV. Bernie Kosar settles himself on my shins and licks my lifeless right hand. Sam takes the keys and gets behind the wheel while Six retrieves our stuff. As soon as we're on the highway, and I no longer hear sirens, I'm able to relax and concentrate on my right hand. The dagger's handle transforms and retreats from my knuckles and wrist. I drop the dagger in the footwell. 15 minutes later, Six tells Sam to pull over, and we screech into the lit parking lot of a closed diner. She jumps out before the car has come to a complete stop, leaving the door open.
"Help me,"
she orders. "Six, I don't want to be a dick right now, but I can't really move my arms and legs."
"Dude, just really try. We have to get them off our tail," she says. "If we don't, then you're dead. Think about it."
I struggle into a seated position and feel blood circulate to my legs. I climb out of the car and waver, there in my burned clothes, having no idea what she needs help with.
"Find the bug," she says. "Sam, keep the car running."
"Roger,"
he says.
"Find the what?"
I ask.
"They use bugs to track vehicles. Trust me, they did it with me and Katerina."
"What does it look like?"
"I have no idea, but time is short, so look fast."
I almost want to laugh. There isn't a single thing in the world I think I could do fast right now. But, nonetheless, Six goes racing around the SUV while I slowly drop to a knee and manage to crawl beneath it, flashing my hands on its undercarriage. Bernie Kosar gets to sniffing, starting at the bumper and moving his way forward. I spot it almost immediately. A small circular object no bigger than a quarter stuck to the plastic cover of the gas tank.
"Got it!"
I yell, plucking it off. I pull myself out and hand the device to Six while remaining on my back. She briefly studies it, then drops it in her pocket.
"Aren't you going to destroy it?"
"No,"
she answers.
"Check again. We have to make sure there isn't a second or a third."
I crawl back under with my hands blazing, scooting from the back of the SUV to the front. I don't see anything.
"You're sure?"
she asks when I stand.
"Yes."
We get back in and speed away. It's 2 o'clock in the morning and Sam heads west. With Six's instructions, he keeps the SUV between 85 and 90, and I can't help but worry about police. After 30 miles, he jumps onto an interstate and drives south.
"We're almost there,"
she says. 2 miles later, she tells Sam to get off the interstate.
"Stop! Right here! Stop!"
Sam slams the brakes beside an idling semi whose owner is pumping gas. Six goes invisible and steps out, leaving the door ajar.
"What's she doing?" Sam asks.
"I don't know."
After a few seconds, the open door slams shut. Six reappears and tells Sam to get us back onto the highway, this time heading north. She's relaxed a bit, no longer holding a white-knuckled grip on the dashboard.
"Are you really going to make me ask what you just did?"
I say. She glances over.
"That truck was on its way to Miami. I stuck the tracking device on the underside of its trailer. Hopefully they'll lose a few hours trailing him south while we drive north."
I shake my head. "Should be an interesting night for that trucker." Once we're past the Ocala exits, Six tells Sam to get off and park behind a strip mall a few minutes from the interstate.
"We sleep here tonight," Six says. "Actually, we'll take turns sleeping."
Sam opens his door and turns his body sideways to dangle his feet out of the SUV.
Guys, I probably should have mentioned this earlier, but, well, I got cut pretty bad back there, and it's really starting to hurt, and I think I'm about to pass out.
What? I scramble out of the vehicle and stand in front of him. He pulls up the dirty right leg of his jeans to reveal a wound above the knee that's slightly smaller than a credit card, though probably an inch deep. Dried and fresh blood cover his knee and shin. "Good Lord, Sam," I say. "When did that happen?"
"Right before I got a hold of that Moog sword, I kind of pulled it out of my leg."
"All right, come on, get out of the car," I say. "Get on the ground." Six shoves her head under Sam's armpit and helps him to the ground. I open the back and retrieve the healing stone from the chest. "Better hold on to something, man. This might sting." Six offers her hand, and he takes it. The second I press the stone to his wound, he writhes in agony as every muscle tightens. It seems like he's going to pass out. The skin around his wound turns white, then black, then to the bright red color of blood. And I immediately regret attempting to use the stone on a human. Did Henri ever say it won't work on them? I'm trying to remember as Sam lets out a long-winded groan that empties him of air. The outer edge of the wound seals inward and then disappears altogether. Sam relaxes his grip on Six's hand, and he slowly regains his breath. After a minute, he's able to sit up.
"Man, do I ever want to be an alien," he finally says. "You guys get to do way too many cool things."
"You had me worried there for a second, buddy," I say. "Wasn't sure if it would work on you since some of the other stuff from the chest doesn't."
"Me either,"
Six adds. She leans over and kisses him on his dirty cheek. Sam lies back down and sighs. Six laughs and rubs her hand over his head of stubble, and I'm surprised by how much jealousy bubbles inside me. "Do you want to go to the hospital?" I ask.
"I want to stay right here," he says. "Forever."
"You know what? We were pretty lucky we were out on that walk," Six says after we settle back into the SUV.
"You're right," I say. Sam places his right cheek on his headrest so he can look at both of us.
"Why were you guys out walking in the first place?"
"I couldn't sleep, neither could Six," I answer, which, technically, is the truth. But it doesn't take away the guilt. I know that Sarah is the girl for me, but I can't seem to stop these new feelings I have. Six sighs.
"You know what this means, right?"
"What?"
"They've probably opened my chest."
"You don't know that for sure."
"No, I don't. But after I grabbed that rock from your chest and it started pulsing and hurting my hand, I haven't been able to shake the feeling I got from it. And it just now came to me that it probably has something to do with my chest."
"They've had your chest for 3 years now," I say. "So you think it's possible for them to open the chests without us? Without us being dead?" She shrugs.
"I don't know. Maybe. But I have this feeling that they got into mine and that when I touched that stone, it somehow led the scouts to our house."
"Why send so few?" Sam asks between yawns. "I mean, why not wait for reinforcements before attacking?"
"Maybe they got scared and panicked," Six offers.
"Maybe one of them wanted to be the hero," I say. Six rolls down her window and listens.
When she's satisfied, she says, "Regardless, next time there will be more of them. Pikins and crawls and whatever else they can throw at us."
"You're probably right," Sam whispers.
He's drifting off.
"I'll tell you one thing. This being on the run is really wearing me down."
"Try doing it for 11 years, I say.
"I think I'm a little homesick," he mumbles.
I lean forward and see that in his lap he's holding his father's old glasses, the ones with the thick lenses he used to wear in paradise. "It's not too late to go back, Sam. You know that, right?" He frowns.
"I'm not going back."
It's with far less conviction this time around than when he had first said it in the North Carolina motel.
"Not until I find my dad, or until I at least learn what happened to him."
"His dad?" Six mouths to me confused.
"Later,"
I mouth back. "Fair enough," I say. "We'll figure it out eventually." I turn back to Six.
"So, where do we head tomorrow morning?"
"Now that it seems they opened my chest, I guess we'll see where the wind carries us." "It hasn't let me down yet," she says in a wistful sort of tone, then glances over at me. "Did you know that if it wasn't for the wind and my need for caffeine one night in Pennsylvania, the night before the attack in Paradise, I'd have never gotten there in time?"
"What are you talking about?" I ask.
"I was drifting through the Midwest, sensing you guys were in Ohio or in West Virginia or Pennsylvania, after I found some news online of what I thought was probably the handiwork of Moogs in Athens near that college. But after a few weeks of coming up empty, I was certain I'd lost your trail. I figured you guys had taken off for California or Canada by that point. So there I was, standing in the parking lot of this strip mall, tired and lost, practically broke, when this huge gust of wind ripped past me and blew open the door to a coffee shop on my left. I thought I would refuel and get back out there and figure something out. But in the corner of the shop was an open computer for customers. I bought a large coffee and started searching the internet. Sure enough, I found an article about the house on fire that you jumped out of."
I'm embarrassed to know how easy it was to find me. No wonder Henri wanted to keep me home or at school all the time.
"If it wasn't for that gust of wind opening that door, I would have probably ended up in a diner instead, sipping coffee until daylight. I wrote down all the information I could find on you guys, and then I ran down the street looking for an all-night copy place. That's when I sent the fax and the letter with my number, to try to warn you guys, or, at the very least, to tip you off, so you could brace yourselves until I got there. And I arrived just in the nick of time."
Chapter 18. The wind carries us north to an Alabama motel, where we stay two nights, again thanks to Sam using one of my identities. From there, we drive west and spend a night beneath the stars in an open field in Oklahoma, which we follow up with two more nights in a Holiday Inn on the outskirts of Omaha, Nebraska. And from there, for no apparent reason, at least for no reason she'll admit to, Six drives 1,000 miles east to rent a log cabin nestled in the mountains of the Maryland Panhandle, a mere 5-minute drive to the West Virginia border, and 3 short hours from the Mogadorian Cave. We're exactly 197 miles from Paradise, Ohio, where our journey first began. Half a tank of gas from Sarah. Before my eyes even open, I can already feel it's going to be a tough day. One of those days when the reality of Henri's death will hit me like a sledgehammer, and no matter what I do, the pain won't leave. I've been having these days more often. Days filled with remorse, filled with guilt,
filled with a genuine sadness to know I'll never talk to him again. The thought cripples me. I wish I could change it, but as Henri once said,
some things can never be undone.
And then there's Sarah, and the terrible guilt that's crept in since leaving Florida for allowing myself to get so close to Six that I almost kissed her. I take a deep breath, finally opening my eyes. The pale morning light enters the room. Henri's letter, I think. I have no choice but to read it now. It's too dangerous to delay it any longer, not after almost losing it in Florida. I slip my hand beneath the pillow and remove the diamond-bladed dagger and the letter. I've been keeping both of them close to me. I stare at the envelope for a moment, trying to imagine under what circumstances the letter was written. Then I sigh, knowing it doesn't really matter, and that I'm just wasting time. And with the dagger, I make a clean cut along the envelope's seal and remove the pages. Henri's perfect handwriting fills 5 yellow legal-sized sheets with thick, black ink. I take a deep breath, and then let my eyes fall upon the top sheet.
January 19. J. I've written this letter many times over the years, never knowing whether it might be my last. But if you're reading this now, then surely the answer is yes. I am sorry, John. I truly am. We Sepans who came, our duty was to protect you 9 at all costs, including our lives. But as I put down these words at our kitchen table, mere hours after you saved me in Athens, I know it's never been duty that has kept you and me together, but rather love that will always be a stronger bond than any obligation. The truth is that my death was always going to happen. The only variables were when and how, and if it hadn't been for you, then I would have certainly died today. Whatever the circumstances of my death, please don't blame yourself. You never expected to survive here, and when we left Lorien all those years ago, I knew I'd never be going back. In the time between me writing these words and you reading them, I wonder how much you've discovered. I'm confident you now know that I kept a lot from you. Probably more than I should have. For most of your life, I wanted you to stay focused, to train hard. I wanted to give you as normal a life on Earth as I could. I'm sure you'll find that idea laughable, but to know the full truth would have added a world of stress during an already stressful time. Where to begin? Your father's name was Liren. He was brave and powerful, and he lived his life with integrity and purpose. As you witnessed during your visions of the war, he carried out these traits until the very end, even when he knew the war was unwinnable. And that's about all any of us can really hope for, to die with our dignity, to die with honor and valor, to die knowing we did everything we could. That was the epitome of who your father was. It's the epitome of who you are, too, even if you don't necessarily believe it.
I sit up, my back flat against the headboard, rereading my father's name over and over. The lump in my throat expands into a rock. I wish Sarah was here, urging me to read on, her head on my shoulder. I focus my eyes on the next paragraph.
When you were just a small child, your father came around even when he wasn't supposed to. He adored you, and he could sit for hours watching you play in the grass with Hadley. I wonder now, have you discovered Bernie Kosar's true identity? And while I'm sure you don't remember much of those youthful days, I can safely say You were a happy boy. For a brief while, you had the sort of childhood all children deserve, though not all receive. While I spent considerable time with your father, I met your mother only once. Her name was Lara, and, like your father, she was reserved, and maybe even a little shy. I tell you this now because I want you to know who you are, and who you come from. You come from a simple family, of simple means, and the truth that I've always wanted to share with you is that we didn't leave Lorien because of where we happened to be that day. Our being at the airfield, it wasn't sheer happenstance. We were there because when the attack began, the guard rallied together to get you there. Many sacrificed their lives in the process. There were supposed to be 10 of you, though, as you know, only 9 made it off.
Tears blur my vision. I slide my fingers over my mother's name. Lara. Lara and Liren. I wonder what my Lorik name was, if it also started with an L. I wonder, if there wasn't a war, if I would have had a younger sister or brother. So much has been taken from me.
When the 10 of you were born, Lorien recognized your strong hearts, your wills, your compassion, and in turn she bestowed the 10 of you with the roles you're all meant to assume. The roles of the original 10 elders. What this means is that, in time, those of you left will grow to be far stronger than anything Lorien has ever seen before. Far stronger even than the original 10 elders from whom you've received your inheritances. The Mogadorians know this, which is why they're hunting you so feverishly now. They've grown desperate and have flooded this planet with spies. I never told you the truth because I feared it might drive you to arrogance and that you might be led astray. And there's far too much danger out there looking for you to risk that. I urge you, become strong, grow into the role you are meant to assume, and then find the others. Those of you left, you can still win this war. The last thing I have to tell you is that we didn't move to paradise by chance. Your legacies were delayed, and I had begun to worry. And when my worry grew to a full-out panic when the 3rd scar appeared, knowing you are next, I decided to seek out the one man who might hold the key to finding the others. When we arrived on Earth, there were 9 humans waiting for us, who understood our situation and our need to scatter. They were allies of the Lorik, and the last time we were here, 15 years ago, they were all given a transmission device that would turn itself on only if it came into contact with one of our ships. They were there that night to provide us guidance in the transition from Lorien to Earth, to help us get started. None of us had ever been here before. When we stepped off the ship, we were each given 2 pairs of clothes, a packet of instructions to help us learn this planet's ways, and a slip of paper with an address on it. The addresses were a place to start, not to stay, and none of us knew where the others were headed. Ours led us to a small town in Northern California. It was a nice, quiet place, 15 minutes from the coast. I taught you to ride a bike there and fly a kite, and more simple things like tying your shoes, which I had to first teach myself. We stayed 6 months, and then we went about our way, as I knew we must. The man who met you and me, our guide, was from here, from Paradise, and I sought him because I was desperate to know where the others first went. But when we arrived here, the dark stars must have fallen, because the man was already gone. This man who met us that first day, who gave us a cultural guide to follow, and who set us up in our first homes, his name was Malcolm Good, Sam's father. What I'm telling you now, John, is that I believe Sam was right. I believe his father was abducted. For Sam's sake, I can only hope he's still alive. And if Sam's still with you, I ask that you tell him this information. And I hope he finds comfort in hearing it. Become who you are meant to become, John. Grow strong and powerful, and never forget for a minute the things you've learned along the way. Be noble, confident, and brave. Live with the same sort of dignity and valor that you inherited from your father, and trust in your heart and your will, as Lorien trusts in it still to this day. Never lose faith in yourself, and never lose hope. Remember, even when this world throws its worst and then turns its back, there is still always hope. And I'm certain, someday, you'll make it back home. With love, your friend and Saipan, H.
Blood pounds in my ears, and despite what Henri has written, I know in my heart that if we'd left Paradise when he'd wanted to, then he'd still be alive. We'd still be together. He came to the school to save me, because it was his duty to, and because he loved me, and now he's gone. I take a deep breath, wipe my face with the back of my hand, and then walk from my room. Despite his bad leg, Sam insisted on taking the second floor, even when Six and I offered to take it instead. I go up the stairs now and knock on his door. I enter and flip his bedside lamp on, and I see his father's old glasses on the nightstand. Sam stirs. Sam? Hey, Sam? Sorry to wake you up, but there's some major shit you need to know. That gets his attention, and he pulls off the blanket. Tell me, then. First, you have to promise not to get mad. I want you to know that I had no idea of any of what I'm about to tell you until just now. And whatever Henri's reasons were for not telling you to your face, you have to forgive him. He scoots up the mattress until his back rests on the headboard.
Damn, John, tell me already.
Promise me.
Fine, I promise.
I hand him the letter. I should have read it sooner, Sam. I'm really sorry I didn't. I leave the room and close his door to give him the privacy he deserves. I'm not sure how he'll react. There's no telling how a person will accept the answer to the question they've asked most of their life, the question that's haunted them. I walk down the stairs and slip out the back door with Bernie Kosar, who runs into the forest. I sit on the top of a picnic table. I can see my breath in the cool February air. Darkness is pushed to the west, while the morning light bleeds in from the east. I stare up at the half moon and wonder if Sarah is looking at it, or if any of the others might be seeing it. Me and the others, the five still alive, are meant to assume the roles of the elders. I still don't entirely understand what that means. Then I close my eyes and lift my face towards the sky. I stay that way until the door slides open behind me. I turn expecting to see Sam, but it's Six. She climbs up on the picnic table and sits next to me. I offer her a weak smile, but she doesn't return it.
I heard you walk out here. Is everything okay? Did you and Sam have a fight or something?
She asks. What? No, why?
All I know is he's crying on the couch downstairs and he won't talk to me.
I pause before telling her. I finally read the letter Henri left behind. There's some stuff about Sam, he and I haven't told you. It's about his dad.
What about his dad? Everything okay?
I turn my body so our knees touch.